And from art and therapy to art as therapy. That's the title of a recent book from philosopher Alain de Botton. Maybe you're familiar with the concept of art therapy, making art to deal with depression or grief or some other pain. But Alain has a different idea, that just looking at art can be therapeutic.
And really, that the starting point is so simple. What is the point of looking at art? And it's such a kind of naive question that sophisticated people like to think, well, obviously, you know, we always knew that a long time ago. But I just go back to the beginning, because I've often felt a bit puzzled in museums and in front of works of art and just thought, how does this fit into my life? Is there any sort of good or bad way of behaving in front of this work of art? And it's kind of my belief that at the end of the day, if art's going to matter to us, it's got to, in some ways, do something for us. It's a tool.
Well, so, for example, let's take a painting everyone knows, the Mona Lisa. What kind of therapeutic insights might the Mona Lisa inspire? We all know it's important, but you're talking about going a little beyond that.
That's right. First of all, the Mona Lisa is such a difficult painting to have any kind of personal relationship with, for the simple reason that it's so famous.
It's also behind about three sheets of glass.
Right. In other words, you're going to have a very unnatural relationship with it. So the first thing to do is to remember that at the end of the day, you are not an art historical scholar, you're not about to pass an exam. If this thing's going to matter to you, it's because you have to enjoy it. And just ask yourself a very simple question: what do I like about this painting? And, you know, one of the things that's quite nice about this painting is that the Mona Lisa looks quite nice. Now, this seems really odd and really sort of stupid thing to say. But, you know, if you wanted a friend and you were sort of looking around, you might think, actually, this woman's quite friendly. And why do you think she looks friendly? Well, there's something about her eyes and her mouth which seems tender, complicated, slightly humorous, but indulgent. She's the sort of person that you feel like you could tell something a little bit embarrassing to. And it's such a basic thing. But you know when people go to a cafe and they say things like, I love sitting around because I can people watch. Now, what is people watching? People watching is looking around at people's faces and trying to imagine who they are. We know that pleasure. It's a pleasure that we should feel entitled to take into the museum, because there too, we're surrounded by people's faces. And even though that face might have been from the 14th century or the 11th century, the same thing's going on. What kind of person would this be?
But that's lovely. Instead of looking at the Mona Lisa as a famous painting, you're just looking at her as a friend, an interesting person. And then she's perhaps helping you access feelings inside, emotions that you might then examine in yourself.
That's right. And this is very much the approach of the book. At one point, we look at a mother and child, you know, beautiful classical Bellini mother and child. You know, there are thousands of them in museums around the world. And when you just step back and think, okay, what is going on here? Why is it nice to look at this? This is basically a work of art that is making the idea of hanging out with your mother when you're about 8 months and sitting on her lap, it's reminding you of a deep sort of primordial joy and sense of security, which, of course, as we grow up, we're not supposed to be mummies, boys and girls. We're supposed to be tough, grown-up creatures. But all of us long, particularly at moments of difficulty, at things were not going right, etc., we long to go back to that primitive, primal cuddle.
It's almost like getting a little hit of tenderness.
That's right. And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the word tenderness, because tenderness has got really low esteem. But I'm really interested in tenderness. I think there isn't enough tenderness in the world, which is separate from mawkishness or sentimentality or soppiness or any of these derogatory terms. Tenderness is a due recognition of the vulnerability that is in each of us. And the reason why the mother and child was such a popular kind of icon of Western art is that it taps into something psychological, you know, that came along way before religion did.
So I'm curious, what would you change about the experience of going to a museum? Because right now, let's say, you know, we go to a famous museum, we walk through the galleries, we stop in front of paintings, we read the little tag on the next to the painting, you know, it tells us the artist, the title, maybe when it was painted. Is there anything in that you would change?
Look, I think that museums have unbelievable prestige in our societies. You know, in every big city in the United States, when there's some surplus wealth, what do people use that surplus wealth for? They give it to the museum. In the same way that in the Middle Ages in Europe, people used to give money to the cathedral. It's like it's the place of the highest repository of values. But when you go into these places, they promise, I think, to do more than they actually do. And part of the reason is that they've been hijacked by an unfair academic agenda. So just think of the way that the rooms are laid out. They're laid out by things like, you know, the Renaissance, the 19th century, you know, Impressionism, Cubism, etc. These are the names of the rooms. But as an ordinary member of the public, I'm not interested in a room in Cubism just like this. I carry the sort of things that we all care about, interest in work, mortality, friends, family. And if I was in charge of organizing museums, what I would do is I would give over sections and rooms to particular themes in our life. So, for example, there would be a room on love, some rooms on love. And the room on love would put before your eyes a number of works of art that aim to stimulate, provoke, re-enchant and nourish you in the areas of relationships. You know, in the National Gallery in London, there's a picture by Pisano called Daphnis and Chloe, which shows a loving couple on the very first night that they've been together. It's incredibly tender and incredibly full of appreciation. And, you know, I would show any married couple with a couple of kids and a busy work life, I would take them back to that Pisano and I'd say, that's how you guys used to be. Just remember how it used to be and look at where you are now and think about that level of appreciation. I would use that picture as a way of provoking those thoughts.
Well, there's in your book another painting you'd suggest for your room on love, I think, is a painting Manet did of a bunch of asparagus.
Right. You know, one of the things that people complain about in long-term relationships is things are a little boring. You know, it's always the same person. And you cease to notice anything special. And one of the things about artists, you know, it's one of the defining characteristics of artists is they spot things in places where no one has bothered to look. They take the supposedly ordinary and they say, hang on a minute, that thing's not so ordinary. There's something pretty special going on there. So if you think of Manet, he did a famous painting of some asparagus in late 19th century France, and he turned these ordinary asparagus into objects of extraordinary beauty, complexity, subtlety. And when you look at them, you think, wow, these things are great. And, you know, if you can do that with some asparagus, you can do that with an even more complicated thing called your husband
your
or wife.
Spouse.
Your spouse. You can do it to them.
You know, people's taste in art is so extremely personal. I mean, the painting I love might be something you hate. You might love minimalist architecture. I might get all excited by Byzantine mosaics. Do you think that's because subconsciously we're each actually looking for something that we need?
Yes, I think that what we love in art tells us an awful lot about ourselves. But I think particularly it tells us what we're slightly missing. So just to give you a personal example, what I really find beautiful in art and particularly architecture is emptiness. I love peace, harmony, calm. So I love this kind of minimalist interiors, or I love vistas of the Utah desert. You know, that really gets me going. Now, what's going on there? What is it I'm missing? Truth is that day to day I'm assaulted by a million emails, things to do, panic, worries, etc. And what I long for and I find so beautiful is something that is the opposite of that. It's almost like the work of art is my true home from which I've been exiled day to day.
Well, this is where we should talk about the other project you did in conjunction with the book. You created an app, correct? Which is sort of like a first step toward having a painting playlist you can own.
That's right. So we've come up with this app. It's called artisttherapy.com. You come into it and there's a kind of little diagnostic tool which just asks, it gives you various moods. So, you know, if you click on the complaint is, I find it hard to relax. And I advocate looking at a beautiful picture by Sugimoto, the Japanese photographer, of some of the North Atlantic on a misty day. And it's just a huge horizon. And feeling small is a wonderful emotion to go for. Feeling small in a vast universe seriously calms down all the complaints of the ego, the anger, the disappointment that comes from not feeling important enough in the world of men and women. And works of art, again, have this great ability to take us out of ourselves. Very valuable.
So you also created the School of Life in London, which, among other things, offers bibliotherapy, the concept of the novel as cure. Sounds like in the future you could imagine seeing a therapist and, you know, maybe you're suffering with work anxiety or depression, and the therapist might prescribe you a book to read and a few paintings to go see.
The reason why that sounds strange is that we're used to thinking that culture, you know, the great works, the great pictures, etc., that they don't have any ability to shed light on the great dilemmas and sufferings and pains that all of us go through from the moment of birth to death. I passionately disagree. And my whole professional career has been spent arguing against that. You know, a few years ago, I wrote a book called How Proust Can Change Your Life. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Proust scholars came out and said, how do you mean Proust can change your life? And the book was utterly serious. It was an attempt to say, well, of course he can change our lives. If a book matters to us, it's because it can do something for us. And, you know, there's this word self-help, which is in serious trouble. Because when people mention the word self-help, they immediately imagine an idiotic book with a pink cover promising you unrealistic things. It doesn't have to be that way. You know, Plato's Symposium is a self-help book. Emerson's essays are self-help books. Walden's Thoreau is a self-help book. We need to rehabilitate that word. The most serious works of culture can alleviate our day-to-day lives and situations, and that this is not any kind of disparagement or attempt to attack them. It's actually a way of doing them proper justice, because that's what their authors and creators would have wanted.
Alain de Botton is the co-author with John Armstrong of Art as Therapy. By the way, several museums, including the Art Gallery of Ontario, have invited him to curate their galleries.